right. Hello, friends. It's Chapo back at it again. And I'm excited to get into today's episode because Matt, Chris, and myself are joined by the creators of one of my favorite things on television this year. It is Sam Lipman-Stern and Adam Balolo, creators of Telemarketers. Boys, welcome to the show.
Yo, yo.
Thanks for having us.
This series is like has been a 15-year journey for you. And really what you've uncovered in this story is really one about a cancer of technology that has infected all forms of telecommunication. Basically, if you're like me, if you get a call from an unrecognized number, like your soul is frozen in fear from the poison or theft that is surely to be on the other line waiting for you if you pick it up. But you tell the story of how this came to be, and watching it was funny, and it was a great TV show, but it mostly made me really angry that we allow this shit to happen in our society. So, Adam and Sam, for people who haven't seen the show, what is this shit that is making me so mad?
Yeah, I mean, it's a beast, man. It's a tentacled monster.
It's been going on since the dawn of since the telephone was created. I think one of the first telephone calls was a telemarketing call.
Yep, we did hear that.
I'm not joking.
Was it like Alexander Graham Bell raising money for the Scottish Fire Department or something?
Yeah, basically.
Well, like you said, like there are so many tentacles to this story, and there are so many big themes of the Telemarketers TV series. But I'm gonna start with like a smaller one, but an unmistakable one from Telemarketers, which is that this is very much a portrayal and a valorization of New Jersey tri-state area shitheads and scumbags who really are the heroes of this program. So I just want to ask you, Sam, like, what was it like growing up in New Jersey? What's the Jersey that you bring to light in this series, and what does it mean to you?
Growing up in New Jersey was really interesting. So I grew up in a Jewish hippie household. So my parents are just total hippies. I felt like growing up in a commune, but I grew up in an apartment complex in central New Jersey, you know? So my parents are total trippy old school lefties.
Is that why they were okay with you dropping out of high school in ninth grade?
100%
CDG. Yeah.
Yeah, we were told we were like free range kids. But so you have that. I had that hippie background. But then, you know, New Jersey, where I grew up, with this industrial wasteland. You know, you're 40 yeah. minutes south of New York City. You've got lots of train tracks and abandoned buildings and dirty water, but then you have all this graffiti. You know, I got into graffiti when I was a teenager. So I grew up in this, like, I was this interesting science experiment of like the multiculturalism that is central New Jersey, because it's one of the most densely populated states. And growing up in apartments in Jersey, you have, you know, friends from all over the world living in these really tight apartment complexes, hippie parents, and then got into graffiti because everything was covered in graffiti. So we tried to make Jersey like a character in this, and because New Jersey is a character. Jersey's a strange place.
But what is it about Jersey in particular that, like, if to tell the story of telemarketing, it is almost like had to be Jersey was like the breakout state that sort of that midwifed this horrible beast into creation, and then I guess sort of perfected in Florida with the contracting model. But like, what is it about the people in New Jersey that made them such good telemarketers?
The people that worked at CDG specifically were hustlers. You know, these were, you know, Jersey people. They have that quote like Jersey strong or whatever. I mean, I think New Jersey's kind of a cutthroat place to grow up. You kind of picture the intro to Sopranos. I mean, is basically central and North Jersey. But CDG specifically hired the company that we, you know, that I started working at as a telemarketer, raising money for police organizations. They would hire, you know, mostly ex-convicts and, you know, drug dealers and graffiti writers and high school dropouts, you know, people that couldn't get jobs other places. So you had, your crazy Jersey characters, but then you also had really street smart people that were able to get money out of folks.
And another huge theme of the show is the American workplace. And I just think of you, Sam, and like What was the education that you got, like, dropping out of high school? Because when you go to high school and college and you think, like, oh, I'm going to have a job, and you imagine what the workplace is like, and then you sort of meet the unofficial real world and the rules that sort of unspoken rules that govern it, and you're like, oh, this is the way things really work. But, like, what was your education dropping out of high school to work at CDG, the Civic Development Group?
Well, yeah, I think the education that I got at Civic Development Group was, well, for one, learning how to interact with all different types of people. I mean, one of the callers, Farouk, who's in episode one, described CDG as working at the United Nations. I mean, you had so many different types of folks from so many different backgrounds. So I mean, I think that was a real education. I mean, you know, you had people from all different races, religions, sexual orientations, different socioeconomic backgrounds. And then you're dealing with people on the phone. So you're constantly being, you know, cursed at, yelled at, and you have to get $200 an hour out of people in donations. So you're learning how to basically kind of hustle in all ways. I mean, you know, even selling drugs in the office, you know, I was selling weed out of the office. Everyone was selling drugs there. So you're like, you're hustling on all levels, but you're also learning how to relate to people on all different levels of society. So I think that was one of the cool things that I learned.
Yeah. A great part about the show and in its depiction of the workplace is that, like, CDG, despite, is sort of a fun place to be, despite it being a, you know, horrible warehouse of exploitation and misery. But, like, sometimes these shitty dead end jobs, like, at least for a certain amount of time, do actually teach you valuable life lessons.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, I dropped out of high school at 14. I didn't feel like I had any future at the time. I felt like a loser, and I worked at CDG for 7 years from 14 to 22. And, everyone at CDG kind of felt like at the bottom, they were at the bottom of society, whether they had just gotten out of prison or whatever it was. And there was this real, like, dysfunctional family environment, which was kind of, there was a real beauty to that. There was something really beautiful about it. Everyone, you know, you can't judge other people when you're at the bottom. No one's judging each other. We're all just existing and trying to make, you know, trying to get by.
The nature of the work itself, though, is fascinating, because, like, you really uncover, like, just by working here, dropping out of high school, this huge story. And it, like, and one of the, like, what CDG really pioneered is this think of fundraising, where, like, if you pay the cops or any kind of, like, anything associated with the civic good, but usually the police or fire department, if you pay them a fee to use their name, then you can solicit all this money on their behalf, even though you're a totally separate entity. Like, you talk about the genius of the CDG pitch model, and as you describe it in the series, selling stickers.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, when I first walked into that office at 14, when I couldn't get it, McDonald's had told me no, Burger King had told me no. They're like, you're too young. And my buddy's like, yo, dude, I'll get you a job in New Brunswick, New Jersey, at this telemarketing company. Didn't tell me any background. And I walked in there, and they taught me how to, you know, the job was to raise money for police organizations and charities. So the idea is that, you know, we would call people on behalf of the biggest police organization in the world, which is the Fraternal Order of Police, and various lodges and, you know, like, different state Fraternal Order of Police groups. And also other police organizations, like police unions and organizations and firefighters. But the main thing, it was built around calling, getting donations for police officers or police groups. And what we would say in the script is that, you know, we'd put on a cop voice. So they taught me at 14 how to sound like a cop. How does a cop sound in a cartoon or from the 50s? You know, you're like, hello, hi, Sam Lupin Stern calling on behalf of the New Jersey Police Heroes Fund. How you doing today? You know, like,
and you don't want to go too far back, though, because then you're like, nothing to see here. Show's over.
Yeah, exactly.
You should probably get more money that way.
We asked for a donation.
Raising money for my sainted mother.
Calling to raise money for the Tammany Hall Fund. The Tammany Hall Workers
Fund.
That would
be hilarious.
Yeah. Like a major theme in the series that I found fascinating is how like this fundraising technique and like how much money that you can raise claiming to like or just being like, on behalf of the police is astonishing. And I think what it really speaks to is that Americans really love the police, but they're also really afraid of them. Because sort of like the part of this deal is like this sticker that you're supposed to put on your car that like not, you know, wink, wink. It could like maybe get you out of a ticket or prevent a cop from harassing you if they're like, oh, I was going to totally fuck up this guy's day. But I saw he has the New Jersey FOP sticker on his car and he's a good guy. Right. It's like you say in the documentary, like you pick up the phone, you don't know who it is. And someone says the word police and people feel a kind of like a deference to authority, but also a fear of that authority.
Oh yeah, that was what it's all. That's what the industry was totally built around that sticker that we would give people, this little shitty sticker for the back of your car, and it was 100% built around what you're saying. I mean, one, you know, people would give to get that sticker. Some people, they wanted the sticker because they thought it would get them out of a ticket or get them out of harassment or whatever. That they put the sticker on the back of their car, and then others were. Half the office in New Brunswick where I worked was Spanish speaking. So you had 30 people or whatever calling citizens across New Jersey or across the country speaking Spanish. So you have a lot of immigrants that are also just there. They think they're being essentially extorted. They have no idea how things work in the United States. They don't know anything. They're like, they get a call asking for a donation to the cops. They're like, yeah, of course, you know, cause they think they might be illegal. They might, who knows, you know? And then you have other people that are just, you know, that will blindly support the police. They want to help. And then you have a lot of grandmas and older folks that, you know, are actually trying to help and do something good. They hear it's going to help the families of officers killed in the line of duty, which was in every single script. That was always part of it. That's what the donations went to help.
By the way, one of my favorite parts in the series is the way that you, Sam, and then all the callers really hit the line killed in the line of duty. Fallen officers killed in the line of duty. And they're really, really just hitting that in the cop voice is great. But like in the second episode, like you talk about how there's a lot of like, you know, you mentioned like half of the audit, half of your the office was Spanish speaking. And you see these FOP stickers on like immigrant businesses everywhere. And, you know, I was thinking like, oh, well, you know, in the countries they're from, it's normal for the police to like, you know, extort money from you for protection. But then I was thinking in those countries, if you pay the police, you might get it. You might actually get protection from them. Whereas in this country, they're just fleecing you.
Yes, totally. Yeah. I mean, I'm in Colombia right now and, you know, I on a vacation, but I live in Colombia. Actually, I've been here for like a couple of years and, you know, here, you know, 50,000 pesos, like 10 bucks. And you know, if you get caught smoking a joint on the street, you pay 50,000 pesos and the cops will let you go. So it's totally a bribery system here in the United States. I guess it's a bribery system in a certain way because you know, you have to pay a lot of money to get a good lawyer. So there is that kind of element of it. But for this, it was just basically, it's kind of like extortion. I mean, hey, we're going to call you. It's for the cops. Going to make a donation. All right, we're going to give you the sticker and you put in your window of your store. And, you know, a lot of immigrants who didn't know any better thought it was getting them protection. And not just immigrants. I think a lot of people in general, I mean, especially a lot of businesses, you know, they might have. And then you have the shields. I mean, we would give out these shields for bigger donations and you see them all over New Jersey, these gold shields on the front of people's cars. It's 100%. Americans thinking they're being protected for having this gold shield that says FOP on it.
I'm wondering, Adam and Sam, like, how do you feel about like the subject matter of your documentary and what you expose given what police departments and fraternal organizations all over the country are doing in light of the controversy surrounding defund the police? So the idea that like police departments don't have enough money because people are angry at them because they're killing too many people or whatever. Like, is it doing this work, like, change your perspective on the police or just merely enhance what you already believe to be true?
Oh, it hasn't changed my perspective at all. I mean, the defund police, the whole idea is ludicrous. The amount of money we pay in taxes to the police. I mean, the idea that police need to raise money is ludicrous.
Yeah.
You know, like, coal miners should be raising money over the phone. Like, teachers should be raising money over the phone. Like, you know, my teacher needs to fundraise, not the fucking cops. They have enough, you know, we pay for them with taxes. So, yeah, I mean, if anything, this whole defund police movement, they, as you see in episode three, they've started using it to their advantage. You know, episode one is really, you know, it's like Billy Fedor, the, you know, in the show says it's all about fear based people giving out of fear or just capitulation. Episode three, it's people giving because they're calling and saying, you know, Antifa is defunding us, so we need your money now. And it's almost like I'm listening to some of these calls and I'm like, I don't feel bad they're ripping these people off. Because if you're giving money for that reason, then, you know, fuck you. Like, so. But still, like, it, you know, it still goes both ways. They're still doing it. They're using the defund police movement to raise more money, but they're still doing the old school tactic of the stickers. Like, that's still going on to this day as well. It's just it's shifted to this, to these political action committees, because they've realized that there's less regulation in the world of political action committees than there is in the world of charities, legit charities.
Adam, because you brought up the PACs issue and how these fundraising techniques are being used for PACs, I wanted to bring up the fact that just yesterday, one of the people featured in your documentary, Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, sent a letter to the FEC or FCC, I think, basically like asking, when are you going to regulate these super PACs? And like, how do you guys make of Senator Richard Blumenthal and like his appearance in your guys' program? He struck me as a bit of a cold fish to you guys. But like, what do you make of this latest letter he sent, and like, and any potential political regulation of these fundraising businesses?
I mean, you know, the regulation for me, when I hear that word, I'm always like, I always roll my eyes. I mean, the problem with this started back with Citizens United, possibly the worst Supreme Court decision in history. And the way that these PACs are able to operate is because of free speech, essentially. It's like, we can call you up and get money out of you on behalf of some bullshit organization, and under the guise that this is a charity, but it's really a political action committee, and we're keeping 99% of the money, and we're going to spend $1,000 on a billboard. And that's the grift. That's the grift nowadays. I'm happy that Blumenthal sent a letter, because that just shows, if anything, I don't think that's, I'm not naive enough to think that's going to fix anything. But if anything, that just shows that, like, we made an impact, and that Pat Pespis wins in the end.
Yes.
I think it's great that he responded. But my only kind of frustration, and I've been following this story for so long, is that he didn't mention the police involvement in his letter. I don't think he really mentioned that, or at least as much as he should have, that, you know, these are the major, this is the biggest police union in the world, in the United States, that's been involved in this scam for, you know, a long, long time. And it's like, until we hold the police unions accountable for their involvement in this crazy industry, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. But I just find it a little bit frustrating that he didn't, you know, they're still not holding the police unions accountable for being like, I mean, they're like this with the telemarketing companies, whether it's the Fraternal Order of Police or the International Union of Police Associations, who's calling, you know, these guys, they're calling right now as we're having this podcast. You know, the police unions are so wrapped up in this. And I think it seems like the senator didn't want to mention the police union's involvement when I read the letter, which is a little, you know, frustrating in my opinion.
Well, Adam, you brought up the star of the series, really. I mean, anyone who's seen the show has become a fan of one Patrick J. Pespis. And I'm just asking, how is Patrick, and like, how has he responded to the success of the show and his sort of status as sort of a folk hero now, thanks to his role as a whistleblower in this telemarketing scam?
I mean, he loves it. He loves the show. You know, anyone who watched the show knows, sadly, that his wife Sue is sick with cancer, and that's his priority at the moment. She's in and out of the hospital every day, so he's not able to do any press. He's not able to really, you know, have as much fun as he could be having, because he's dedicated to to, you know, his wife. But he is, you know, he's taking selfies with people in McDonald's in Jersey. And like, you know, he's definitely feeling some of the effects of modern day fame.
And Sam, I think one of your coworkers, I believe it was Sabrina, in the first episode talks about Patrick's sense of justice and like, you know, his sort of like a self-made sense of fairness and rightness. And I'm just wondering like how you experienced that and where you think it came from that led to his work on this show.
Yeah, Pat is just a really, what you see in the show is from Pat is exactly how Pat is in real life. That's just who he is. He's not putting on any type of act. That's Pat. So Pat was when we were working at CDG, Pat was the guy that, you know, if you had any issue, if your car broke down at the job, you would stay after work just to help and wait till the tow truck came or change a tire. He's just a really empathetic person. He's always helping everyone. You know, he's really well known in his neighborhood. Everyone loves him. You know, he'll give the shirt off his back to help somebody. You know, Pat had a really, we didn't get to go into his childhood too much, but he was raised by motorcycle gangs.
Yeah. Which ones?
Yeah.
The Hell's Angels.
The Hell's Angels.
Yeah. His dad was a famous tattoo artist in New Jersey. He was the most famous tattoo artist.
And Chris the Greek Hespis.
Yeah, yep. Chris the Greek. He's in newspapers back in the day. He was estranged by his father and raised by the Hell's Angels, essentially.
God.
And I think his untraditional childhood was like, I don't know. Maybe that was part of it, but he grew up in a pretty wild childhood, but he's got this really strong moral fiber and he always wants to help. And, you know, you see in episode one, him talking about global warming during the Bush era when we were filming. And he's just like, hey, you know,
he's breaking it down.
He really cares, man. Pat really cares. You know, he was the one that said, hey, we have to do something. We need to expose this thing in the world to the world. You know, I was just like, let's film these crazy characters here. This is so interesting. Here we are, a bunch of ex-cons calling for police organizations. But it was really Pat who was like, we got to get this. We got to tell the world what we're doing so we can stop this thing. You know, I think I'm really proud that we, you know, that we followed through and we made it happen. And here we are. I have friends in the industry now texting me every day. Oh, I just got another call that someone, you know, someone said, oh, I watched the HBO show and they clicked. So we're actually banned. You cannot post Pat or Sam memes in the group chat from the telemarketing company that's doing it right now. I have all my friends. I have, you know, I'm still connected to a lot of these guys who we interviewed, who I knew from back in the day that are still in the industry. And they're huge fans. I mean, everyone's huge fans of the show. They loved it. Only compliments. But the powers that be banned Sam and Pat memes, and I have all the screenshots. Good stuff.
we'll see if Elon Musk does the same, if this gets any bigger.
Yeah.
Pat, I think it's worth noting too, like Pat is an old school Bruce Springsteen leftist. Like when I first met Pat, I was worried. You know, guys, I went walking up to his apartment. I was a little worried that he was going to be a Trump supporter because he's a white guy and he's in his mid 50s and he's working class. So I was a little worried, but I was pleasantly surprised that he's like your old school working class Michael Moore style liberal. I love guys like that. Like that's like my dad, you know.
Yeah, no. Pat name checks Michael Moore several times in the series. Yeah,
because Michael Moore is like his like guiding light. Like
totally.
when we were like, we're gonna make this we're gonna get this documentary going. He was just like, okay, I think he watched all Michael Moore's movies, and he's like, yeah, that's how you're supposed to do it.
I gotta get thrown out of a place.
Yes,
that's key.
Which we did.
Yeah,
we channeled Michael Moore.
Yeah.
So I have a question kind of along the lines of, you know, the dedication and the of it within the character of Pat and also the development of the show, because Sam, you know, you were shooting footage for what would become this show back in like 2007 or something. You know, you've been working on this for like 15 years and you know, from that 2007 era footage, you have footage of Pat talking about like how we got to break this story open. And it's just getting to screen now. So I was just wondering, like, if you could describe the journey that this project took from, you know, you just kind of, I don't want to undersell it, but it's seemingly like dicking around in the offices of CDG in, you know, 15 years ago to realizing that you actually have a story to realizing that there's an actual vector to actually get it on the screen and how you could speak to like the dedication over time of seeing this project from, you know, your very earliest interaction with the company to having an HBO show.
Yeah, man. Good question. I started at 14. As soon as my first day walking into the Civic Development Group office, there was, I've told Adam this before, but there was all these built dudes doing push-ups near the water fountains, just like ripped guys. And then I walk into the office and there's mugshots of the callers. I kid you not. You know, on the walls, like badges, like trophies, badges of honor. And I remember a manager walked up to me my first day on the job, and he pointed out one of the characters that makes a couple of brief appearances in episode one, Mr. Smythe. And he says, "Hey, you see that guy over there?" And Mr. Smythe is, he's become a really good friend, but he's an odd looking human being.
He's got those big eyebrows. Yeah.
And he used to walk around in these like really old, like Vietnam era boots this manager pointed to this guy and I'm 14. He's like, "You see that guy over there, Sam? One day that guy right there, I swear, is going to come in with an AK-47 and shoot this whole place up." I'll bet good money on it. That was like my first day on the job. And, but you know, I was like, you know, reading, I've always loved documentaries. I've loved movies and I was reading a lot of books and, you know, I love like, you know, like Steinbeck and Kerouac and I just started thinking like, these characters are straight out of like a Steinbeck novel or like someone should just write like some, these are just beautiful characters. Like I really started appreciating the characters there, you know, whether Big Ed or Larry Lazar or Sabrina. I mean, there were just so many larger than life, incredible characters. And those are some first little kind of like inklings of just thought, like someone
I was
write
a big
book
fan of X Santino, the God. He was one of my favorite CDG guys. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Shout out to X Santino, the God, man. But yeah, so then
Burger King cup.
Oh yeah. So a few years later, we'd always be like talking between calls, you know, in the aisles of the office. And I was talking to Big Ed Hilger, rest in peace. And he was like, you know, they saw me grow up there. I was, you know, one of the part of the family. They saw me come. I was maybe 17 or 16. And Big Ed, he was like, "Hey, man, look, we're a bunch of losers. You're a teenager. I know you don't want to do this for the rest of your life, telemarketing for some shitty fucking company. Like, what do you want to do with your life?" And I told him that, you know, I was interested in filmmaking. And he's like, "Really? Like, I'm interested too. I love filmmaking. Like, I have a camcorder." And he actually told me to bring my camcorder in the next day. And I was like this really shy, kind of like timid, anxiety ridden teenager. I would have never brought it in without Big Ed being like, "Yo, dude, bring the camera in." Like he really gave me that, like kind of empowered me. And he was also a respected character there. So if Big Ed gave you the thumbs up, like you were good. So yes, brought in the camera the next day, and Ed and I just started filming the shenanigans in the office. You know, just all the shenanigans. And originally it was, "Let's put these videos on YouTube." You know, and we had, there was a few YouTube pages, and people can dig them up online with a little bit of research, but there's still a bunch of videos on YouTube. Big Ed also told me, which we talk about in episode one, he had filmed a tape in the early 2000s or late 90s. It was like one tape of like maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours of footage. And he gave me that tape. And there's some of that in episode one.
That tape is amazing, by the way.
Oh yeah.
I think it should be on display in the MoMA. Like it goes from the CDG office to a motel where Ed is being entertained by a couple strippers.
Oh my God.
And it is so grimy and so real. And it's a beautiful piece of work. I want to put it out as really? Like a 90-minute feature film.
I think we should, actually. But yeah, so we're in the office filming the characters, and then Pat just came to the forefront of, you know, being the most charismatic, definitely one of, if not the most legendary caller to ever come out of that office. And he just kind of came to the forefront, and so it kind of became, let's make a movie about Pat and mm-hmm. a day in the life of a CDG caller. And then Pat, you know, one day was kind of like, hey man, let's start an investigation into this. Let's not do just a movie about, you know, one crazy caller. Let's expose this thing to the world. So that was basically how it, you know, that was the trajectory, you know. And then years later, I met my cousin Adam in LA. You know, I'm living in LA, you know, years later. And, you know, I was living in Los Angeles. My mom, like, worried Jewish mothers, like, hey, you know, you're all alone in LA. You need to meet your cousin. You got cousins. And I didn't even know, you know, Adam's my cousin-in-law. So I didn't, you know, I knew his wife from childhood. And we ended up meeting up and became really close. You know, I was their only cousins too out there. And then that mm-hmm. was kind of how it took its next shape. Thanks to my mom and also Adam's mother-in-law, who are first cousins, putting us together. And but it's really
the first time in history that ever worked.
totally.
How'd you hold on to all that footage without it like getting lost or something over the years?
That's as a former video guy, that's the only thing I was thinking of, is like, how the hell did the media manage work? What were you shooting on? Were those like DV tapes you kept in like a shoebox for 10 years?
Yeah, DV and high eight. Sam's one of these dudes who you know, he's like a backpacker, right? Like just mm-hmm. traveling around the world, sleeping on couches, but he keeps his tapes like they're gold.
You got to keep the tapes, man.
Yeah. I mean, you got to.
You know, I had an undiagnosed obsessive compulsive disorder and general anxiety disorder for years. I had no idea what it was. I'm just like, oh, I'm just crazy. But finally got diagnosed in my late 20s. You know, shout out to all my people with mental illness. There's the silver lining to OCD is I was meticulous with holding onto that footage, man. I had copies upon copies, and there was a fire at my dad's house in like 2018. And hey, man, that could have wiped out everything. I mean, so I was really, you know, the one silver lining for, you know, if you use your OCD for good, I know it's not, you know, until you have that under control. One good thing, I freaking kept that footage, man. I kept that footage, and I'd have it in three different locations. I put up my mom's, my dad's, a friend's house, like backed it up. Like, but I feel bad for the editor. Shout out to Chris Pasek, a genius editor, and Claire Reed, who our producer, did an incredible job. But when I first handed the footage over to Adam, I gave him this hard drive, and it was a mess, man. It was a mess. Just not labeled. Everything's everywhere. And but we kept it.
If only the New Jersey Fraternal Order of Police knew that only a few house fires could have prevented this whole project from being started. I mean,
There was a raid too. The cops raided my house when I was 18 for graffiti, and a bunch of tapes got lost in that raid too. But shout out to the cops for doing that.
Well, I mean, you mentioned earlier that Pat and Sam memes are banned from the telemarketing group chats, but I'm wondering, like, the show, like in the first episode, it really seems like the villains of the series are like, you know, the sets of brothers that own these and pioneer these telemarketing companies. But as the show goes on, it really becomes clear that like the real criminals here are the cops. And I'm wondering, like, getting banned from the group chat is one thing, but like, are you paranoid now about the police in New Jersey? And I mean, I guess you live in Columbia now, so no problem. But I mean,
yeah,
I just
he
like
doesn't have to worry. Yeah. About that.
Yeah, I'm out here in Columbia, man. So it's interesting. Everybody always asked us, like, every time I told somebody that I was working on this project, anybody, all walks of life, the first question everyone said was, are you scared that the cops are going to come after you or the owners of these companies? And, you know, I think it's like, it's a sad thing that, you know, people have to ask that question. You know, we shouldn't have to feel, you know, as a society terrified of, you know, police coming after us for exposing wrongdoings, you know? So, I mean, look, I think, you know, I never wanted fear to hold me back from doing this project, you know? So I was just like, and I'm back in the States all the time. I'm like back and forth. So yeah, I mean, I think there is look, you know, we are revealing some pretty wild stuff, and, but I think the, you know, so there is definitely, you know, a legitimate fear there for repercussions from the, you know, the police, but I'm, you know, I just kind of put it out of my mind, and I'm like, look, our goal was to tell this story, get it out there so that the money could go to good causes. You know, Americans are very generous and there's so many good causes. You know, we started out calling for police, but part of this whole wheelhouse is the same causes. It's calling Americans, raising donations for police, firefighters, cancer charities and PACs, veterans, and then also now they brought autism into it, and I mean you got these causes that really pull on people's heartstrings, and it's dark stuff, man. I mean, you know, you have these legitimate police unions that are wrapped up in this industry, but then it seems like all the other charities that are using it are just scam charities and PACs that are fully bullshit, self-serving, and they're raising, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and putting it in their own pocket. So, yeah. So to make a long, you know, just to answer the question, I, you know, there is a legitimate concern. I put it out of my mind that I'm just like, because, you know, our goal is just to tell the story, get it out there so that maybe this money can start going to legitimate causes, because there are great, incredible nonprofits out there, just not the ones that are involved in this industry.
Yeah, and I think it's an important point, is that like, even if you're the type of person who is inclined to give to police charities or believe that the police departments are dangerously underfunded or that they need all this extra money to begin with, none of this money is going to like the families of fallen officers or even to buy a fucking like new car for the local sheriff's department. This is going to like celebrity golf outings and fucking like hotel vacations for these Fraternal Order of Police guys.
I'm sorry, you don't think that they deserve that? You don't think that our brave officers deserve a nice trip to Pebble Beach?
I mean, look, fuck out of here.
We really tried hard, you know, Adam and I, like, to, and all the filmmakers, to try to not, like, politicize the documentary. Like, we really tried to just put out the facts. Like, whatever our political leanings are, we just tried to just make it, let's follow the leads and put it out there. And actually, it's been pretty interesting. Their response has been really positive, it seems like, from all sides, you know?
Yeah, did you see our review in the Daily Caller?
Yeah, well, what, a positive review?
Wasn't a joke. Yeah, oh, yeah? Was it effusively positive review?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
We get all our best press from the right-wing media, too.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of our guys at Rough House was like, yo, should we get, is it time to get Pat Pacifist on Tucker Carlson?
I mean,
like, Tucker's too low rent for Pat. Pat needs a way bigger platform than
you're going to be on a Twitter space that collapses halfway through. No, thank you.
Yeah, that would be amazing, actually.
I mean, I think, it's really interesting because, yeah, in my mind, it's just politics aside, it's just it's the fact that the cops have been involved with this, and we're not, you know, again, it's the Fraternal Order Police is really that is the American, they are the biggest police organization in the United States, and they are involved fully wrapped up for, you know, 50 plus years in this crazy, crazy scam.
I mean, like, I'm sorry, like with one degree of removal, they are just sanctioning and profiting from what is literally just robbing old people.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely.
Like, I mean, some of the calls that you record are these old ladies who are literally saying, I'm going to die in several months. And then they're still getting hit up for money.
Yep.
Well, then you also have like, where's this money going? Right. So we're, when the money comes, right, they're saying it's going to families of fallen officers. But, you know, from our research, you know, it's going, maybe they might give a little bit, tiny, tiny fraction to that. But, you know, mostly it's going to politics and politicians. So you have this really strange thing where you have
a lot of lobbying.
So you have ex-convicts and drug addicts and, you know, graffiti writers, you know, who are caught up in the prison pipeline. And that's the rule, not the exception. And with all the telemarketing companies doing this across the country. So then you have them, they're raising money. They're caught up in the prison pipeline. They're raising money for police organizations. The police organizations are using that money to basically keep American policing exactly how they want it to be. And it's this weird, vicious cycle. It's so strange. It's, you know, that's what's helping to keep laws in this country, you know, and keep reform happening.
You know what? You guys would love this. There was a clip that we had to cut out of the show that Sam found. And it was a corporate video made by the Fraternal Order of Police the Legal Defense Fund. And it is pure gold. You've got, it's basically, so a lot of this money is going to this Legal Defense Fund. And what the Legal Defense Fund does is it protects crooked cops. So you have them being interviewed.
The Bad Lieutenants Benevolence Association.
Exactly. You've got these guys being interviewed in this corporate video, and they're like, and this one guy's like, I never knew I was going to kill a guy. And I went to work one day and I killed this guy. And the very next day, the Legal Defense Fund got me back on the job, got me fast tracked back. And I was making money. I was back on it. And I didn't have to worry about nothing.
I didn't know I was going to kill a guy January 9th, 2001. Officers, you know, everybody says routine. There's no such thing.
The Legal Defense Plan offers broad coverage designed to protect you and your professional reputation.
The department would have dropped me. I know that if I would have been indicted. And with the attorney I had, I felt he was the best attorney and I owe my life to him, or I would be in prison.
No officer should be forced to sacrifice his family's financial well-being to defend his actions in the line of duty.
And this is their video. Yeah. We got to send you guys this video. It's
really badly made and 90s, and it's fucking hell. It's great. You guys,
Legal made us cut it, but it is a gem. It starts with a group of, it starts with a huge, like, battalion of cops beating down this poor unsuspecting victim's door with like hard rock music. Anyways, really, I'll send you guys this. You can put it on the website.
Yeah, there's no Legal here at Chapo Trap House. We can put it out. Yeah.
We're going to make that fucking thing go viral.
Well, as long as we're talking about killing people and the irony of having a criminal solicit on behalf of the law enforcement, I got to talk about Sam. I saw you talking about this with Staub the other day. But one of my favorite characters from the documentary was, of course, the telemarketing murderer, who's one of the best callers in New Jersey, who did like, what, a 30-year stretch for raping and murdering this girl.
Now that's the guy that Sam needs to be afraid of.
Not the
police. It's the serial killer.
He's been training to run a marathon.
Yeah. He's training to run a marathon.
Really fast. Oh, yeah, man.
I love how somebody pointed out the bottle of lotion, though, on next to his computer.
Oh, yeah, everyone. Yeah. So that Thomas Bailiff, man, I believe in redemption. I believe in, but this guy should not be on the streets. Like I'm like, you know, it's so darkly funny, but you have people that are in prison right now for fucking marijuana. Still, this dude. All right, so this guy, you can find him online, Thomas Bailiff, if you look him up. There was a girl on the street. Him and his buddy pull her into their car. They rape her. Thomas Bailiff stabs her in the heart, kills her, drops her in a field. He was a suspect in other rapes in the area, convicted of another rape. He does 30 years in prison. He gets out after 30 years. He's living in his parents' house in a room that hasn't been changed since the 1980s. So all the old boom boxes, all the clothes, all the pictures, it's carbon. He's in the 1980s, and he's the best caller right now. He's calling, told people at the call center that he was tricked into calling, supposedly. But, you know, look, this guy, every time, you know, I'm filming with this guy, and, you know, I'm like this, you know, just filming. And he, every time someone hangs up on him, he is cursing at them with this like deep anger, man, like he's murdering somebody on the phone. Every time he's telling people, I hope you fucking die. I hope your whole family gets shot up. I mean, he was
I'll burn your fucking house down. Yeah.
I mean, look, there was stuff that didn't make it down, in there. Yeah. Like, yeah, you know, he was using racial slurs. He went real, dude, it was intense. And I couldn't believe that he was just letting me film it and didn't say anything. But I think that goes to show how deeply dark and twisted this dude's mind is. I mean, he shouldn't be on the streets. Like, there's no way. And I'm curious if his parole officer saw the video, because this guy should not. But he's the best caller. He kills it on the phone. He's like, they can't lose this guy. I mean, he's still calling after the documentary came out. But he's, yeah, I mean, that was just, I mean, it just shows the how this telemarketing industry is just so wild. But he's getting people's addresses, credit card information, and calling for the biggest police organizations in the United States. I mean, it is just, you can't make this shit up. It's fucking nuts.
If they put him in jail, he could still make the calls. It just makes it a little more secure for everybody else.
That's the next step.
Yeah.
Well, actually, no, AI is, they don't even need them anymore.
One of the grimmest parts of the entire series is when one of the callers featured in the first episode is resurrected in the third episode via the miracle of artificial intelligence. Because they have recordings of so many hours of your guys on the phone that now, I guess with AI, they can just take. They can take your soul and trap it at CDG forever, bilking elderly people out of their social security money.
That was shocking to us.
It's true. It's coming for all of us. It's coming for you guys, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, rest in peace, Joe Mako, man. I mean, he was in we interviewed him in the first episode. You know, you see him in episode one, and he's, you know, he's laughing on camera. And then, you know, here he is right now as we're in this podcast. He's calling people.
He's
raising money
from the grave,
from the beyond the grave.
Yeah, it's insane.
The show really does, like as you talked about, become really about the entire sector of what we refer to as the nonprofit like industry, like the nonprofit. And like, you know, you talk to sort of like a consumer advocate, and he like wants to make clear, you know, they're obviously very good and worthwhile charities, but like a huge part of the nonprofit world is just scams all the way down. And I guess that's what made me like I said, this feeling of anger watching this series is just like, what a fucking rinky dink country we are that we just let, like you said, like Adam, like the idea that we even need to like call people on the phone to raise money for the police is ludicrous. But just the idea that like the entire American idea of charity is that we just can't have anything good. Like we can't use any money, public money, for a public good without just all sorts of crimes happening. And I'm just like, I don't know. I just like, what do you think your show says about America in the 21st century? I know that's a big question, but nothing too good, I imagine.
I mean, it's a portrait of the dark side of American capitalism run amok. That's all it is, you know, I don't want to be one of those guys who says that, you know, the whole system's broken and capitalism, you know, sucks from top to bottom. Like this is the dark side of it. This is how it can be manipulated and is being manipulated. And, you know, there's a sucker born every minute too. I mean, like Sam said, we are a very generous, Americans are generous. Okay. This scam doesn't happen in other countries because in other countries, people don't give, like, you know, oh, you need money?
Yeah.
Go fuck yourself. Like, go get a job. Like, you know what I mean? Like here we're very generous people. So people can be taken advantage of. And if anything, that's what this, you know, that's what this shows sadly is that this has been happening since the telephone was invented and it's even bigger now.
And one other thing is like, just, you know, we never wanted to demonize any of the callers. Like the callers are just people that are trying to get a, you know, maybe people that couldn't have a felony, you know, once, look, in this country, once you have a felony on your record, you're pretty screwed for a lot of jobs. So, you know, the callers were people that, either couldn't get a, you know, Larry Lazar says in episode one, the best part of CDG is providing jobs to people that are unemployable. And so, yeah, we never wanted to demonize the callers. And, you know, I think it's one thing about this documentary is just, you know, telemarketers always get a bad rap. And what kept happening over and over and is continuing to happen is the telemarketing companies, they get shut down by the government. David Vladek, the former director of the FTC, says that in episode three, he was like, hey, I wish I would have taken you guys down. He's talking to me and Pat saying like, you guys, you're the callers, you're the bad guys. And look, the callers are people that are just trying to make $10 an hour. Most of them didn't even know when we were doing the interviews that it was a scam. They're just like, I don't know. I was just trying to do my job, trying to make $10 an hour. You know, the bad. So thinking about in general, who the bad guys are in you know, you can always demonize the person on the call, but it's really, you know, it's these organizations and millionaires, you know, and heads of these major police organizations that in my opinion, are the wrongdoers in this whole thing.
You know, I actually think that I realized this as I was watching the documentary. I was like, holy crap, I might have actually worked for CDG for like one afternoon in like 2007. Yeah, I mean, it might not have been them, but it was definitely a company doing the exact same thing. It was in Milwaukee, the South Side, in a shitty fucking warehouse. And it was a bunch of young dudes calling on behalf of the firefighters, and they were selling tickets to a Beatles cover band that was going to benefit the local firefighters. And they would do like these big chants to like pump themselves up. And I was sitting next to this guy about my age, this young guy who was making the calls. And then every time somebody said no, he would like do kind of a Jim Carrey incredulous face at the phone, like, what? What? Like, he was just astounded that people were hanging up on him. Like, every time, he was just like, what? What? And, you know, I did the orientation, and then I just realized as I was doing it, this is not for me. And it was not because I had any moral qualms. It was because I just could not bear the thought of all these people getting mad at me on the telephone. So I just, yeah. I had to leave. But I'm pretty sure it was CDG. It was in Milwaukee.
Yeah, so it's so wild, man. And it's not, you know, it may have been born and raised in New Jersey, but this was, you know, this is right now and was, you know, this is something happening all over the United States, these offices. And it's always the same setup. It's ex-convicts and, you know, people that need it. A shitty job, calling for the cops, the firefighters, the veterans, and that's wild, man. That's
the one thing from the script that the one part of the script I remember is they had like a tree and a response for a yes and a no to any question you ask. And they ask them, do you like the Beatles or oldies? I think it was like an oldies cover band, just like a bunch of bands do it. I'm assuming it's very similar to that quote unquote circus that you guys showed, you know, that kind of like bare excuse to sell tickets to something. And you're supposed to say, like, do you like the Beatles? And if they say yes, you say one thing. But if they say no, you were supposed to say, oh, yeah, you sound too young anyway. And then, like, you're supposed to laugh. You were supposed to laugh. And that was the thing I could do. It's like, I'm sorry. It's not, I can't laugh. I can't do it. I had to leave.
That's so good, man.
I wasn't. I mean, the thing is, I didn't need the job bad enough. That's that boiled down to. I didn't have a parole officer I had to worry about.
That might have been M. Charles Productions, which Patrick J. Pespis, our friend, worked for, doing the same
That's
thing.
That's where he started. Yeah, he started selling tickets for firefighters' benefit, just like that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess like the last question I have, and the question I had watching the show is, like, you talk about CDG as sort of like employment of last resort. And I'm wondering, like, if in a different context, could the CDG model be put to good use, hiring like the unemployable or felons or directly out of halfway houses to pay people a decent wage to solicit money for charities, provided that they were real charities? Because, I mean, like, respect to the telemarketers, like the people you portray in this movie are very good at what they do. And I'm just wondering, like, could this be put to like a legitimate charitable use?
I think so. I mean, I think I'd like to think so. That's actually one of the things that if it was used for good charities, I think you could. But at the same time, you don't, all the extracurricular activities might help with sales. Whether it's, you know, smoking crack in the office or shooting heroin or prostitution or that might, you know, I don't, if you take that out of it.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, does it still work? I would hope.
No,
so.
I'm saying let them smoke crack and do heroin, on behalf of legitimate charities. Yeah,
I don't think. So I actually disagree, Will. I don't think so. I don't think that it's reasonable to cold call anyone asking for money. even if it's going to the right place, like, can we just end that practice? Like, can we just be done with it? Like, stop calling people.
Yeah. I mean, especially since the it only makes sense financially, because there's just going to be this huge chunk of money that just gets taken by the people doing the calls. So you can't go to the right places if you wanted it to.
But even if it was totally going to the right places, like, is there a world in which we just stop cold calling people altogether? It seems like a better world.
You'd think we'd be able to pull that off.
You know what? We'll let you guys go with that. Adam Balalow, Sam Lipman-Stern, the show is Telemarketers. We'll leave you with a message. Stop calling people. Please stop using the telephone.
Has ever called someone on the phone, or at least not in the last 10 years. But if you are,
nobody wants to get a phone call ever anymore.
Yeah, like, no, it's violence. Doing that is violence.
It is an act of violence. Yes, I agree.
Thank you guys so much for having us, man. All fans.
Sam and Adam, thanks so much for coming on. And
it was fun.
Thanks again for this series. It was really, really great work. You guys did an amazing job with it. I really enjoyed it.
Love you guys.
Cheers, guys.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
You feel the rush and you know the risk. You watch out for us, but who watches out for you? The Fraternal Order of Police, the largest law enforcement union in the world,